Hi folks, and thanks for listening to this Reboot Republic. A couple of quick things before we kick off. The latest Reboot Republic with Dr. Kieran O'Carroll on climate action and social justice is out right now on patreon.com/tortoiseshack. And I just want to say a quick thank you to everybody for the feedback to the wonderful conversation we had with former 2FM broadcaster, presenter Keith Walsh. And yes, that story has made front page headlines across Ireland. Unfortunately, it does seem that we haven't been credited, which, you know, is a bit of a pain in the arse, but I'm not surprised at all. Legacy media does not like independent media, does not respect independent media. But if you respect us, if you like what we do, please join us. Please go to patreon.com/tortoiseshack. The link is at the top of the podcast you're listening to right now. Say it all the time. It's not just a podcast. It is absolutely activism, and is the easiest bit of activism you can do on a monthly basis. So thanks for listening, thanks for sharing, liking, telling people where to find us. All your feedback, we really appreciate it, negative and positive. Love to see you on the Patreon, but I'm shutting up now. Enjoy the show.
Welcome to Reboot Republic, the podcast that goes behind the headlines and looks at the big issues in this republic of inequality. We are the podcast of solutions and the podcast of hope, and I'm your host, Rory Hearn, and delighted to be joined on the podcast today by my producer and great buddy, Tony Groves. We're going to chat housing. We've loads of statistics, really big ones, important ones out, and also discuss the human side of it, which really, as Tony was making the point, has been lost in all this discussion. Tony, how are you?
I'm good, Rory. And actually, that's unfair. I wasn't making the point. I was making the point that you've never lost sight of how the human impact of this. And that's why it's important. That's the, you know, so it's something that you've always managed to connect from, you know, these headline numbers, because, you know, that and that's really important. But let's start probably with the cold facts and the numbers as we see them. Well, we say facts, the facts as presented. We know that the number is much higher. They are a statistical fudge. But can I ask you, just to, do you want to just go and have a give us a kind of overview, Rory, for the listener's benefit? Because again, you know, it's really scary to see.
It is, yeah. I suppose there's been a couple of stats have come out in the last few days. We saw homelessness, the latest monthly homelessness figures came out. And also we have the annual social housing and affordable housing delivery figures. The truth is, they are all manipulated. They are all spin. But still, because we've been producing them for a number of years, spin and all as they are, they allow us to compare over time what's actually happening. And they're obviously giving at some level. They are giving a picture of reality. They're not giving the full picture. And we'll talk a little bit about that. Just in terms of the homelessness figures, they show that we have now reached the highest ever. We've been breaking it for the last few months. Last month, it was down slightly, but we're back up now. We have the figure in terms of homelessness. I'm after losing it in front of me, Tony.
13,800 and I think 14.
Yes, correct. 13,841. You know, that's individuals. And that is people. Every single one of them is a person with a story, and they are human beings who have a right to dignity as anyone else. But I think it is worth kind of thinking that I was looking there in terms of the figures and comparing, and I think a useful comparison is the starting point of Housing for All, which was September 2021. And in September 2021, which was, you know, we're heading to 3 years ago now, was 8,475. So we're almost 5,000 additional people homeless. Now, it's really important, as I will talk about shortly, to understand that that's just 5,000 people more in emergency accommodation right now. There was a lot more people went into homelessness, went out of it in that period as well. But that is a massive increase in terms of just a percentage. And I think, you know, we've talked about this and I've highlighted a lot. And so one of the things that enrages me most about our whole homelessness crisis over the last 10 years has been how children have been just utterly invisible, abandoned, not by the services like Focus and Simon trying to work with them, but by the government. And the figures now are we have 4,000 170 children in emergency accommodation right now.
Criminal.
4,170.
On their Easter bank holiday weekend. You know, you can imagine the little conversations that you're supposed to have about simple things like, where's the Easter bunny going to come? I know that sounds really silly, but it's not. If you're that parent, if you're a parent, you're going to cry your eyes out thinking about that, you know?
And people will have cried so much getting to there and the experiences of losing the home, because we don't think enough about that either, that what it took and what that child went through to end up in a place in emergency accommodation. Most likely, you know, huge housing stress in private rental sector, possibly a year, possibly 2 years. The mother, father, parent, guardian, like living in absolute stress. And the child looking at that parent. And, you know, there is a personal connection in all of this. And why I suppose I have always focused on the human side. And I spoke to about, you know, this before about, you know, when I was small, we lived unusually in the 1980s in private rental housing. There was very few people living in private rental, particularly families, young families at that point in the 1980s growing up. And I remember us having to leave our home because the landlord wanted to sell the property. We weren't in a position to buy it or invest and do enough what was needed. So we left. And I always remember that kind of, there was two things I remember. One was the whole relationship with the landlord and my parent, you know, having difficult conversations around rent. And I just remember the animosity between them and also that kind of the power. Like at 5 years of age, I remember, you know, this landlord was the powerful person and they had something over us. And then we left and we moved across town and I lost my little friend. Of course, when you're 5 or 6, you know, your friend. I'm not comparing in any way, trying to say that, you know, I was homeless or experienced homelessness. But what it did give me an insight into was that home, the necessity of stability and what it means for kids, you know, and how it stays with you. And, you know, I think of, like, I just can't get my head around it. I come back to 4,170. Like, if you put 4,000 children, I don't know, out on the streets, like in terms of like a line, like you're talking like thousands and thousands of children right now. And the increase, when we look at Housing for All, and I'm surprised this isn't getting more, you know, coverage. And I made the point in Ireland AM during the week that, you know, Harris needs to, you know, bin the plan, that I can't see how they still stand over this plan. In when the plan started, I'll just give you the increase in children, 2,344 children were in emergency accommodation. We're now at 4,000. That's a 78% increase in the number of children homeless with their family. How does any government stand over that? I don't know.
Can I make a point? So I think, yes, it's a great starting point for housing because it shows the housing delivery is meeting nowhere near what it needs to be, even though the government are happy enough to tell you, you know, more built than any time in decades, which is, you know, we know that's a myth because they're basing it off such a low base of what happened after the global financial crash, and we'll come back to that. But we also know then that... We also know that there's, you know, they're missing every social and affordable target, Rory, that's in that mix. So, you know, they're still so over-reliant on the private market, the rental market. And one of the points you made, I believe, on that interview you referred to was the level that was available to buy is so low as well. So we've recategorized all of these cohorts of what makes up a home, and we've made sure that the dominant one in the market is the private rental scheme that are in particularly in urban areas. And then you see, as you said, those 4,000 children. It's why I was very frustrated where people were playing the cult of civility card, saying people should be nice about Leo Varadkar as he leaves the stage. And you're thinking, well, under his watch, because you've gone back to that, he was also in charge when Owen Murphy launched his he took over from Simon Coveney on the previous Rebuilding Ireland plan,
and it was Simon Coveney's Rebuilding Ireland plan.
And Simon Coveney's Rebuilding Ireland plan, he said, "Don't call me crazy. I will end homelessness, people living in hotels within a year." And now, instead of doing that, it's up 600%.
Yeah. Since the start of Rebuilding Ireland. Yeah. And I think that the important, again, I'll come back to why it's so important, is that each of these children who are experiencing that, there's twice as many, and this is, I come with the figures, right? And I found when I was down speaking at my launch meeting of the campaign in Galway yesterday, I went and met the Galway Simon community and asked them, you know, what's going on in the ground, and also spoke to Threshold as well. And what both of them told me, and I don't know whether you'd heard this, Tony, I was shocked. But they said that in the West now that there's a waiting list for access to emergency accommodation. And I nearly fell off my chair. I was going, what do you mean? How can you have a waiting list for emergency accommodation? It's like, you know, the words don't go together. Waiting list, emergency. If you're in emergency, you have to get seen, delivered, responded to immediately. You can't be told, ah, come back when we're in a position to help you out. And they said, yes, there's families, which we actually interviewed, I don't know if you remember, prior to the lifting of the eviction ban. We had a family, one of the family's mothers who spoke on this podcast said that they rang Galway when they were in facing eviction, and Galway County Council told them, we've no emergency accommodation. And so now they're saying that there's a waiting list to get into emergency accommodation.
Shock. That's shocking. That's absolutely shocking. In a country that is like, I keep saying this line, I'm sure listeners are fed up me saying it. This is why we feel poor in a country that's supposed to be mega rich. Because the truth is, housing financialization has pushed so many people to poverty that it's just, whether it be through private rental, whether it be reliance on HAP, whether it be reliance on, you know, just waiting to get out of these things. Because, like, I don't know if you saw it yesterday, Rory, Apple's most recent report came out on the profits. And again, I use that word lightly, profits, because they avail of intellectual property rights that they move to Ireland and they switch things around. They recorded profits that are the equivalent of nearly 12.5% of the entire Irish economy. Think about that. Like
12.5%.
Now, Rory, I put it to you this way. They don't employ more than 0.5% of the Irish working population, and they're booking profits of 12.5% of the Irish economy. This is why we have this huge gap between, you know, the tax servicing industries and everybody else,
Yeah, it's a really important point, because what it highlights is two things. One is that, and in some ways, the corporations are making the profits and they should be taxed absolutely, you know, properly. And the issue is that we also have huge resources within our government budget. Like, we have 8 billion of a surplus that they put into, and the Simon communities were talking about this. Like, think for a second, how does the homeless person, how does the young person, an increasingly middle-aged person stuck living at home in their parents' box room, think about when they hear the government saying, oh, we're not going to invest this surplus right now, we're going to put it into a rainy day fund. And they're going like, oh, so my situation of absolute trauma, exclusion doesn't matter. I don't matter. And then we wonder why we've a rise in the far right, and we wonder why we've a rise of racism, and when you've people who are literally being told, you don't matter.
Yeah, I mean, this is this morning. So I received the message, agree with Tony, daughter and boyfriend living with me currently, but they're going to Canada in July. Son works in Dublin, lives with his father in Portlaoise, has to be in the office 2 days a week, 17-hour days because he can't, because that's the turnaround time. None of them show up in any of our figures, Rory. But this is what, you know, this is the life delayed. This is the, and this is where the anger does come from then, because it's easier then to say, and it's a point actually Martin makes quite well. He says, we've created a lower rung on the ladder now. And the problem with creating that lower rung is that unfortunately, it's easier to punch down than it is to look up sometimes. And that's unfortunate. And again, some of that is a problem of
I wouldn't say it's easier. I would say it's easier. What I would say is that it is, maybe you are right. Maybe it is easier, but I feel that it's also, people aren't offered an alternative.
There's two things, because that's what the politics dictates to a large degree. That's what a lot of media goes along with, that narrative. You know, you were going to have to remember, it was, I think, 2017 when Leo Varadkar walked around saying this level of homelessness is normal. And he repeated it over and over. Hills Far Away.
Yeah, but sure. Dara O'Brien said the same thing recently, pretty much, which is like, oh, homelessness is a really complex causes, you know.
And I'm sure.
It's like, yeah, the lack of housing, you.
It's just insane. Can I make it? I want to talk about a couple of things that are really important. You mentioned the no-fault eviction ban. We had that in place. We saw the impact that it had. We now have a new Taoiseach in place for whatever he has. My word, should he not just grab the bull by the horns and say, I'm gonna put that back in?
Yeah, absolutely. No, I think you're completely right. And the lifting of the eviction ban, and we did a huge campaign around that, Tony.
We helped to get it delayed by about 3 months, but that was as far as we got. Like...
That was as far as we got, you know. And a lot of people worked with us, Uplift and others, you know, and Dean and the whole lot. We really pushed hard on it, and Brezzy and others. And I described it at the time, you know, we were talking about it. I think it was one of the most callous decisions any Irish government has ever made, because they said that they knew when it was lifted that homelessness would increase. And I said, at the time, that how could you have a government that actually says, we have a policy, we know if we do it, it will increase homelessness, but we're going to do it anyway. And as someone said, actually, when a crisis goes on for so long, I think you've said it before as well, when a crisis goes along for so long, it's no longer a crisis, it's government policy.
But I want to make a very quick point to this, because
But I think you're right, though, to put the point on Harris. If Harris is serious about saying, oh, I'm now, you know, I've got a backbone, I'm changing things now, I'm going to stand up and, you know, for security for people. Absolutely. The eviction ban, reinstate the eviction ban should be absolutely top of the list, along with getting rid of housing for all, just, which is there.
No. And no, I want can, to go can through I just some make of the one, figures. One quick point to go.
Yeah.
Same thing happened 6 years ago when we sat in a hotel room in Dublin city centre when the then Special Rapporteur for Housing, Leilani Farrell, wrote to the Irish government and said, this is going to be a disaster, you're going to increase homelessness, you're going to make, you know, you're financialising housing, it's going to get worse. It was then at the time Minister for Finance, Pascal Dunne, who wrote back and says, no, we're not, plan is working, in a 4-page response, and everybody just nodded their heads and went off on their way. And, you know, it's like we're supposed to forget that they were told that this would, you do this, this will happen. And now we're told with the eviction ban, you do this, this will happen. You know, luckily some of us can remember back beyond, you know, the memories of goldfish. So, but it just doesn't.
Well, it's also, that is frustrating. All right. How everything just moves on so quickly and there's no real analysis, no critical analysis. Like I've pointed out, the issue, for example, let's do a couple of the figures that have come out around social housing and affordable housing. Social housing, they're saying they built, they provided, they say, 12,000 homes, social homes last year. When you start to break that down, you actually see that 2,000 of those are leasing. Right? This is what investor funds lobbied for, that the government wouldn't buy social housing. They would lease them off it because then it's basically another part of their build-to-rent model that they can sell as contracts and the state doesn't get social housing. And there's a big question. What happens at the end of that lease to the tenants who are in social housing? Nobody's answered that yet.
Because they know they won't...
Do we see evictions of thousands and thousands of people from social housing because the investor fund wants to sell it on? But anyway, we'll come back to that. Then 8,000 built, right? We know of that 8,000, loads of them are just bought from the market. They're not
most of them are what they call turnkey.
Yeah. So it's taking away from the market supply, which is adding inflation to the market when you've the state being another buyer. The figure for Dublin last year was only 9% of all the new homes built were bought by a home buyer. Of all the new, so this, they're going to have this great new supply, and when 9%, like it's just all this expensive built to rent. Or the state buying as social housing when, of course, it should be built in it. The affordable housing stuff, though, is the one where it's great. Like, talk about manipulation of figures. They say they delivered 4,000 affordable homes, okay? You and me think, that's great. Cost rental housing is, you know, thousands of cost rental homes, thousands of affordable purchase. But actually, when you go into the figures, again, it's fall off your chair sort of stuff, you know? The actual number... of how many cost rental homes would you say local authorities delivered 800. Last year? 22.
Right.
How many did AHBs deliver? 286. The LDA, 561.
By the way, I want your attention to those LDA ones because they're some of the most expensive cost. Expensive cost rental units ever delivered anywhere.
Yeah, and it's a flawed model if you're basically buying from the market as well, because you're
buying. The minister called it, when I put him under pressure in this very room where I sit now, he said, well, it's kind of a hybrid.
Yeah, kind of a hybrid, exactly. So let's go there. So they said they have 4,000 affordable units delivered, only 1,000 cost rental. So were all the rest 3,000 affordable purchase? They weren't. How many local authority affordable purchase houses? 500. So actually only 1,500 cost rental and affordable purchase were delivered last year. The rest were the first home scheme, the first home equity pump up the market scheme, subsidy for developer scheme.
So if you subtract it out and say 1,500, you could pick any year between say 81 and 87, and Dublin City Council built more homes itself than all of the local authorities combined in that period.
Absolutely. And sorry, I'm just going to jump really quickly back to the social housing figure, because they're saying we delivered more social housing than ever in the country in the 1970s. And again, we made the point, you cannot compare what we're delivering now to the 1970s, because our population, it was 3 million then, it's now 5 million, right? So it's a 2/3 increase of population. So if you're actually going to be delivering per capita the same amount of social housing as the 1970s, we'd need to be building 17,000 social homes.
No, I do think, again, have you seen this where they've selectively said, it was always the way they would say, you know, the most homes built, most homes ever built in the last 9 years and 4 months, because they would go back to exactly when, you know, everything went off a cliff, like kind of thing. And it's just...
Yeah, and what's going to be very interesting is if they all say now, okay, there's this growing acceptance that we need to be delivering, let's say, 50,000, the figure is between 50,000 and 60,000 homes each year, that means the social and affordable housing targets have to be increased as a percentage, as a relative figure. So if you're talking about, you know, we need to be delivering between probably...
No, one,
sorry, go on. Yeah, 15,000 social and 15,000 affordable.
Of course we do, we're supposed to be increasing our stock from 8% to 10% to 12%. You know, we're supposed to be going somewhere of
25%.
So we've a lot of... We're not only not... We're going to... The share will get smaller. The share only got bigger because we decided... through a trick to call a lot of HAP tenancies social housing, and...
Absolutely. And he had I looked at the press release that they put out on the social housing figures. He says it in at Dara O'Brien, our social housing waiting list has reduced 36% in recent years. It's now at 58,000, because it doesn't include the 60,000 HAP households.
It's staggering. So for listeners' benefit, what they did with a stroke of a pen is they decided that the housing assistance payment was social housing. And then it could remove you from the list. And even though that meant you were still renting in the private market, you were never more than 6 months away from, you know, a notice to quit, and you had no security. That is not social housing. Actually, the minister, before he went into the office, before they went into government, he agreed with that point of view. Now he's availing of the trick around it. One thing, Rory, I want to bring, you don't know if you saw this, it's really important, because listeners need to hear this. And Pascal Donoghue sitting around with the head of the Eurogroup, you know, he's still in there plugging away in his role as president in there. They are looking to relaunch the re-release the bank securitization models, right? Do you remember these? These were
securitizing of mortgages.
Baby, we're back, baby. We can. Do you remember we used to bundle the loans, call them AAA rating, and then sell them out into the market,
trade them on the markets.
So the EU are looking.
They were very successful.
It only brought down the global economy. Like, you know, it literally, you know, I had a stress dream about this last night. I'm not kidding. I had a stress dream last night, and I don't know why, but part of the thing I had to do was to get the information to someone. I had to jump off a cliff face and throw a parachute to try and land. I go, why am I doing this? This is mad. No one's listening. We were going back down this road again. We want to go back into this because we need another financial instrument to give banks more mechanisms to make more money, even though they've made out like bandits on untaxed profits on having done nothing because of just higher interest rates. It's absolutely terrifying to me. I'm telling you, it's terrifying.
No, it is. And it's part of the global financial sort of, what is the word, paradox, or, you know, we recovered from the financial crisis in 2007 through the huge quantitative easing by the, you know, the central banks and the European Central Bank that flooded essentially equity funds, which also then invested in real estate and including our very own country. And there's this kind of capitalism itself, and neoliberal capitalism has been in a crisis since, you know, David Harvey, the economic geographer, you know, talks about it from the 1990s. And even that essentially productive capitalism is facing a problem. And this is Piketty stuff, you know, the rate of return from, you know, investment in property, wealth is higher than the rate of return from investment in the productive economy and labour. And they essentially have a number of very high, corporations that make a profit, but the rest of the economy is quite stagnant, does not provide the return on investment. And so you have this massive global wealth and wealth funds that are looking for places to invest their money that isn't the real economy because it doesn't give them enough return. So they look to, for these instruments to be created to extract their return. And this is where we haven't solved this problem that that and the neoliberal, you know, economy is economy that's not based on a sustainable form of economic growth. And there's, you know, part of that essentially is down to inequality, that huge wealth growth at the top, trying to find places that it can make a huge return. And it is sort of that wider thing I think is very interesting in terms of my European campaign. It's very interesting to see this kind of connection between Europe and Europe's potential to kind of control and regulate that, you know, you're looking at me in a disbelief.
No, I
do think that, like, because it's not just me making this, there's other people around Europe who are making the argument.
Can I make one quick point?
That Europe has to regulate speculative capital and control
the only time we saw insurance premiums, for example, come down in Ireland was when it was the European Commission got involved. It wasn't because, oh, Murphy finally got a grip of the oligopical practices. It was nothing to do with that at all. It was because of Margaret Vestager's teams came in and said, yeah, no, you guys are price fixing. And all of a sudden, so it can, it does have the powers to pull levers that can make people act and react, and that's okay. But what I'm saying to you is now, my terrifying, that it also can be a power for bad if you're sitting around in the president of the Eurogroup and you're saying, actually, you know what we need to do? We need to give the banks another opportunity to...
Absolutely, of course. Yeah, definitely. No, I completely agree with you. And I think it was very interesting as well. Another thing, which is, you know, around solutions and you know, and I think we need to give, and people are saying this, you know, and asking, like, what's the solution? You know, what, where, how can we get out of this? And it's interesting, one of them we talked about there already, the 8 billion we have for surplus and X billion next year and billion the year after. And I've made the case and you know, others and, you know, yourself as well, that we should be investing it in things like the local authorities' capacities, the not-for-profit housing bodies, you know, a state building agency, state building company. And the government is kind of getting away with it by buying housing off the market rather than actually building the capacity up long term, hiring architects, hiring QSs, hiring builders, like, you know, and actually building its capacity over the long term. And, you know, taking on and creating a capacity within the state to deliver housing just as it does with health and education. And I do think that's the solution. The other solution, as you said, very clearly, the eviction ban, reinstating that eviction ban. The other one, tackling Airbnb, which has really come up again as a major issue, regulating, the EU has a role in that as well. But just to say, I think what was very interesting, I don't know if you saw, Tony, during the week, that there's talk, you know, von der Leyen is pushing the whole European defence, European army stuff. I heard that they're talking about looking at using the European Investment Bank to invest in weapons, defence spending. And my understanding is that the European Investment Bank was set up essentially to invest in social and economic infrastructure, things like housing. It actually part funded the cost rental development in St. Michael's Estate. And so I think when we look at Europe and we look at what could be done, and people say, what are solutions? The solutions are, is you use funding streams and funding to invest in homes, not bloody weapons.
That's staggering that we're considering doing. Well, it's not actually. It's not. But I mean, we had this argument when the EIB was available to give us money at rates that could have, as the ESRI said, double it up. You know, double up. You know, what would I call capitalists like Eric Lonergan, fund managers like Eric Lonergan saying, get that money while it's at negative interest rates. Take it, run, you know, rebuild your infrastructure, your economy. Instead, we've got the worst of both worlds. We didn't invest. We decided that we'd actually put the golden egg away for a rainy day when it's pissing down on people outside already. And now if we want to go back into the market, we're going to pay higher rates. But I do think rates are going to start coming down shortly.
Well, that's the thing. So then we need to bring the argument back again. There's like, you know, the EIB, I assume as well, well, you know, we know it can offer lower interest rates over longer term. Do you know what I mean? Mm-hmm. It doesn't have to offer the market rate. It can offer lower interest rates. So again, I think the pressure should be coming back on the government to say, look, we have money, you know, we can invest. But their argument about this argument is that their main argument appears to be that, oh, if you invest more money, we don't have the capacity.
No way.
You know, that you're going to hit inflation and we don't. And they seem to have really convinced people around
this.
Yeah,
but they also convinced people here in Ireland that austerity saved the country, and that wasn't true.
No.
I've spoken to political correspondents in the last 6 months who still tell me that's the case. Like, they do. They still tell you that that's the case. So it...
That yeah. austerity worked? For who?
This is the point, you know. And there's also Rory, you only have to look around and see the amount of people who are sitting in reasonable chairs close to seats of power saying the cost of living crisis is over, but then you look at the mortgage arrears numbers and you know it's absolutely not.
Yeah. And deprivation figures, which we spoke about with Ciarán Nugent, I was looking at them again, and he points out that only 30%, almost one in three workers are, well, he put it, you know, one paycheck away from basically poverty, which was the statistic, the indicator he used. And I looked it up because I was struck by that when he said it. And I'd really encourage people to listen back.
Great,
to
isn't
podcast. He? Yeah, really, really good. But the indicator on the deprivation score is on the deprivation measure is being able to afford a once-off emergency cost without having to go to borrowing. And one in three workers could not afford an unexpected expense without going to borrowing. So that basically means they have nothing.
So if your car breaks down, folks, you don't have the money to repair the car.
The child is seriously sick, and there's expenses come in with having to go stay at a hospital or whatever.
Right,
it is.
I'm conscious of time because I know we've other things, but I want to make one point on that you said. We know of families who were saving for deposits for homes, that, you know, working two jobs, commuting long distances, and then a child got sick, and then they found themselves with a notice to quit, no ability to get a mortgage anymore because they had to deplete their savings to work on things. So we know that the social contract isn't working for anyone. That's what we know. And we know we need it. We need something. I argued after the financial crisis, it wasn't my idea, but I know it was taken up by lots of people. I can't remember who I stole it from, but the EU could create solidarity in the morning by when they were, you know, dispersing this money that they gave out through QE, if they sent people checks with the EU signature on it, you'd feel much more European in the morning. You know, you'd absolutely go into this. Where we're really struggling now, unfortunately, is in that sense of solidarity from both the EU and within Ireland, because it is becoming more and more polarized, and unfortunately our society is becoming more polarized, and I'm really concerned, because I mean the statistics are bearing it out now that now more Ukrainians are going home than are arriving. Okay, It's still Ireland is not full, yet we have to deal with this narrative. And now we've decided that this election coming up, everything has to be the end of woke politics. What are you talking about? Why you say the end of woke politics when what you really mean is we're lurching to the right? That's what you mean. Say what you mean.
Yeah.
Rant over.
Absolutely. And I think it's rant over. No, I agree. And I think we have to reassert and put across that there are there is an alternative way of doing all this, an alternative way of looking at it, that it is about the solutions that we set out there. It is about looking at, and it is about solving those issues, the housing, the health, and true investment, public investment. And it is about a caring society. And that's the reality, like, and moving away from neoliberalism up, like, you know, it's, that's what we need. But it was interesting, the meeting down in Galway, I have to say, my launch meeting. It was good to see sort of people really engaging, and there is a real hunger for change. And also, I was really struck by the hunger and question about what are the solutions? People really want to know. And it's interesting how you see that the narratives that I just said there, for example, about, oh, if we invested, it'll impact inflation. Like, people think, you know, people are thinking, you know, how do you overcome that? Is that not true? You know, because they look around and they hear that, you know, we don't have this capacity, and they hear local authorities are getting all this money. And you go, well, okay, they're getting money. They've just been given money to buy houses. They're not been given money to take on architects, engineers, develop planning expertise, develop an ability to deliver housing, take on, you know, the LDA, for example, is not taking on, you know, construction workers, construction capacity. So I think we have to show, actually, if we really want to solve it, they're the ways we go about it. Yeah. But listen, Tony, as always, great to chat. I really appreciated that. And I think our listeners will enjoy that, and hopefully give them a bit more information and as well. And lads,
thank you to everybody who chipped in for Zach's GoFundMe. It's been absolutely astounding to see. We've nearly raised the full amount in less than 4 days, I think it is now. It's incredible. And check out Rory's campaign page.
Thank you, Tony. And really, fair play to you in terms of organising that for Zach. That's brilliant. And again, I suppose just, you know, we were both at the Palestine demo last weekend, and it really was exactly what, when we were talking with Abdullah about, you know, that moment where you feel, you know, we can give hope here, and it's so important, everything everybody does. Every bit of action gives hope. So whatever you can, do it. Thanks so much. And we will talk. And as always, of course, keeping the lights on. There's only one way to do it. Go over to patreon.com/TonyRoves.
the link is at the top of the podcast. We'll talk to you soon, folks. Bye-bye.
Talk to you all. Thanks.
Great, Rory.